educational lessons from the Mishkan, from the Tabernacle. You know, the parshiot, the various Torah portions that we're reading starting last week, for the next month really, are some of, if I may say so without getting in trouble, some of the most boring in the entirety of the Torah. You know, we don't have the wonderful narratives of Abraham and Sarah, you know, teaching about monotheism to people like we've discussed. We don't have the stories about Joseph and his brothers and them fighting. When, you know, God's not bringing miracles and smiting Egypt. This is, you know, the intricate details of how to build a table and a candelabra. And, you know, in this upcoming week's parsha, it's you know, how to construct the tunic that, you know, the priests were going to wear. They're not thrilling, but one of the lessons that I learned a long time ago is that the quote-unquote boring sections of the Torah are sometimes the areas that are most ripe with lessons for us to take away. And the way things are built, the way things are structured, the way the text is formulated is in and of itself a lesson for us to learn. And what kind of jumped out at me this last week, and that I've been thinking about, is how many educational lessons come from the tabernacle, from the Jewish temple. And when we say education, I mean, I happen to be a classroom teacher. I don't mean, you know, in a classroom. And when we say education, I really mean the term chinuch. You know, a friend of mine, Rabbi David Beshefkin, pointed out that there are a lot of different words for education in Hebrew, in Lashon HaKodesh. It, you know, on the one hand, we might say a mora or a mora. You know, many of us know a mora so and so, and frequently those kind of personalities we interact with as a young child, and maybe as you get older, you might meet a malamed, and you might meet a machanech, and all of those things practically mean education. But a mora is someone who is sort of a guide, and we talk about someone who's a mora derech. Is a tour guide, and a mora is sort of showing you a path, and that's sort of one approach. A malamed, coming from the language of lilmod, to learn, a malamed is someone that teaches you, that facilitates the person learning. A machanech is a very different kind of role. Machanech is from the language of chinuch, really means a preparer, and you're someone who consecrates or prepares an item or an individual for long term goals or successes. And all of these exist. I like to think of myself as a mechanech, that I prepare my students more so than even, you know, informing them or showing them what to do, but to prepare them more holistically. But the nuanced details don't matter that much. The takeaway and the point that I'm hoping to make and to introduce is that to think of education as beginning with childhood and ending at 18, 21, you know, whenever people, you know, some of us like to go to school for a long time, to think of education in a Jewish sense, it is too narrow. Education, that, like what we're going to discuss tonight, starts from the youngest of ages. It's sort of the very first thing we were trying to do with our children. You know, from the moment that a child is able to speak and understand, our rabbis teach us that you're supposed to teach the child Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe, Morashah Kihos Yaakov. You know, my son is about 14 months. He's not really talking. He's like a little bit talking. It's a debate in the family if when he says Abba, he's referring to me or to the picture of me on the wall, because we point to the picture more than we point to me. But when we talk about education, we start as young as possible. And so I'll sing Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe to my little son. But education applies. But as always, education is applying whether we're 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, until the very last day of our lives. We always want to be learning and growing. My mother and uncle are, you know, they're siblings, and they're a funny pair. And one day, because my uncle's a huge nerd, he decides to look up the word adult. You know, what does it mean to be an adult? And the dictionary definition, we have a very large Webster's dictionary at home, says it's to an individual who stops growing. And so he decided, not uncharacteristically, that he has no interest in being an adult. He never wants to stop growing. And education is really the best way for us to ensure that. I tell my students all the time a quote from Mark Twain, well, two quotes from Mark Twain, that I happen to love. One of them this is what I really try to impress on my students, is that those who don't read have no power over those who can't read, and sort of the necessity of engaging in education. But he also said that Mark Twain said he tried very hard to never let school get in the way of his education. And so as we talk about education, I don't want us to get bogged down with the images of classrooms and the images of individuals, even though that might be the frame that we're using here, because I think it applies across the board, no matter how young or old we are. And so with that introduction, I'm just going to share my screen. If anyone's interested in the source sheet, I'm happy to share it afterward. But as the way that things have gone in the past, screen sharing is perfectly sufficient. So I'm going to share now, and we're going to open with, we'll say, a long-term perspective. Because when we think about the challenges of education, we think about the challenges that exist in trying to impart information upon someone else, it's not easy. It's not easy to convince someone else that I know, maybe I wouldn't say better, but I know something that's worthwhile for you to listen to. And it didn't just start now. Let's take a look. This is from 1932. Now, the individual we're looking at, this is Rabbi Kolonimus Kalman Shapira. He's often referred to as the Eish Kodesh, which is his most famous books that he published. But he was the rabbi in the Warsaw Ghetto. And not just the rabbi, he was a Hasidic rebbe. And traditionally, Hasidic rebbeim, there's a lot of grandeur, they're usually quite regal, and they interact with the grown-ups, with the adults. He was called the rabbi of the children. And whenever a kid would come along, he might be having an important meeting, but he'd always play with the kid a little bit, maybe put the kid on his lap, maybe continue what he's doing. He'd also often, while sharing discourses, he would have kids sitting on his lap because they felt so comfortable with him. And he wrote a book specifically geared toward 11 and 12-year-olds called the Chovos HaTalmidim, the responsibilities or the obligations of a student. But he opens it with an introduction and really a call to educators and to parents. And he points out a problem that doesn't sound so unfamiliar, even though this was 90 years ago. But just taking a look at the bottom, he wonders, we're just going to read it in English. He says, why is it that in previous generations, any type of education was effective? Almost all the students of every teacher and almost all the children of every parent were servants of God. But now, it's no longer so. Nowadays, you were trying to teach somebody about Judaism, you're trying to teach someone the truths and the values of Torah. Maybe they listen, maybe they don't. And he basically explains to us, the simple and main reason is that the youth are thinking that they are already adults before their time. They're convinced, what do you have to tell me for? I know this already. The smartest people in the whole world are 16, 17, 18-year-olds. They have a quote about the guy who said, when I was 18, I knew much more than my dad, but by the time I became a father, he seemed to learn a lot very quickly. And he says, there's a level of insanity happening here, that you've got young people with no life experience, and yet they're convinced that they know more than people with so much more experience than they. The irony here of me talking to people who know so much more than I do about so many things is readily apparent, but I researched this a little bit, so I don't feel so badly. And he said it's actually an indication of the coming of the Messiah, that in the world today, people have so little regard and respect for what their elders know. That's actually a direct quote from the Gemara at the end of Masechet Sota, that at the end of days, in the times before the Messiah, brazenness will grow, chutzpah will run rampant. And so in the 1930s, there's this concern that people don't care what their elders have to say. They're convinced that they're right and that no one else is right. But it doesn't stop there, because when I was studying education, when I was getting my master's, I met this individual named Alexander Southern, or really A.S. Neal. And Neal had created something called the Summerhill School. And I don't know if anyone's familiar with the Summerhill School. He published books about it. But he was into the concept of a free school. I actually have a cousin who attended one of these free schools. And the basic point was, do not teach anything. That concept of education, suggested Neil, is totally incorrect. All that a quote-unquote educator is supposed to do is to let people learn on their own. And effectively, he ascribed to this air of insanity, as the Chovos HaTalmidim referred to it. He said, yeah, who says that I know more than this person? Let him let her figure it out on their own. And that, who am I to inculcate beliefs into someone else? And this in the 1960s is very much what he espoused, what he taught. And I mean, he wasn't the most popular in the time, but he was definitely part of the conversation about education. Moving back to the Jewish realm, Dr. Jonathan Sarno, who was actually a professor of my brother's in Brandeis and is kind of an expert in Judaism, if you will, he pointed out that faith in general is very hard to teach these days. You know, in 1994, he said, once upon a time, most people in this country adhere to the faith and ethnicity of their parents. Their cultural identity was determined largely by their descent. But now, religious and ethical loyalties are more commonly matters of choice. Identity, to a considerable degree, is based upon consent. And so, not just in the 1930s and not in the 60s, but in the 90s, you have people who are saying, well, I'm not so convinced that just because I grew up with something, that just because this is sort of what's been shared with me my whole life, that I'm going to stick with it. We seem to be living in a world that ascribes to this concept of postmodernism. Now, is anyone deeply familiar with postmodernism? Because I'm sure I'm going to butcher it somewhat if you really know what's going on. So if anybody wants to jump in and explain, I'd much prefer to hear what you have to say. All I have is the Encyclopedia Britannica explanation and what my friend told me when we were in college. Very well, I'll do my best. The notion of postmodernism is that we don't assume that there's such thing as an objective reality, that you experience life one way, I experience life a different way, and that nothing is necessarily and entirely true. Now, this really has played out to a large extent in our culture and in the world today. We see this in the way that people talk about opinions overall. We see this in the way that people talk about gender, that there's not that things are relative and not necessarily, you know, binary. And we see it in so many different aspects that the way that the world approaches things today, we don't make any assumption that anything is absolute, that anything is true, that this is a world of relativism, of general suspicion of reason. And we've even seen educational programs born from this concept. You know, the Montessori schools, not just the free school that existed in the 60s, but a Montessori school is really focused on the notion of who's to say that what I think is important to teach is really the most important thing. And so with that, I guess, little introduction of a few sources, we've spanned almost a century of the progression of, you know, people like aren't really so interested, they're convinced that they're right, to basically no one cares what anyone else has to say. And in a political world, people complain about this all the time, that everyone's so convinced that they must be right. But, you know, as Jews, it's not just that, you know, it's very hard to convince someone else that I'm right. But as Jews, we have a tradition. We get together once a month to discuss our tradition. We get together all the time to discuss it. But this group gets together once a month to discuss our tradition. And is that just because it's interesting, or do we feel like there's something more to it, that there's something of value beyond just the interesting, you know, approaches that, you know, maybe Rabbi Gold takes when he explores, you know, Book of Psalms? Is there, we feel that, you know, this is a message from the divine. This is something that our ancestors have studied and that we continue to study. But why? And how are we supposed to communicate the value of this to someone else? And maybe that someone else is a child, is our child, is another child, maybe it's a family member, but maybe it's just a friend. And what we're going to try and see, the lessons maybe that we can pull from the tabernacle, is maybe some ways that we can impart, not even necessarily what I think, but what someone much greater, much more important thinks, you know, what God thinks about certain things. You know, I played a game with my students last night. It's called See, Run, Build. Has anyone ever played See, Run, Build? It's a camp game. And effectively, it's a three-part game. I took a collection of Legos. Don't tell my aunt this. She gave me a box of Legos 2 years ago, like when everyone was at home. And she's like, this will be great for relaxing. And I did not play with my Legos at all. But I opened them for the first time this past week. And I took the Legos and I built a structure. You know, we built a structure and I put it in the corner. And then I gave two groups all the necessary materials to build that same structure. So, if, you know, if there were three long blocks, they got three long blocks. And I had a circle on my thing and they got circles. But mine was fully assembled. But theirs was totally separated into individual, about 20 or so pieces. And there was a job that you had a seer who was allowed to look at the item. You had a builder who was looking at the raw pieces and a runner in between. See, run, build. The trick is, the seer is only allowed to see the item and talk to the runner. The runner is only allowed to talk to the seer and the builder, but never allowed to see the finished product nor the materials. And the builder is only hearing from the runner, and so no one really gets the full picture. And we finished playing the game, and you know, this is during school. And at one point, one of my students, kind of hesitantly, because this is a bad question to ask, was like, what does this have to do with school? Like, why are we playing a game instead of in class? And I was like, ah, you'll see. So we finished the game, and we kind of unpacked the challenges therein. And one of the lessons that I ultimately left them with was that Jewish values, the Torah, it might exist sort of in its perfect ideal form, but that's not the Torah that we experience. You know, that might be the seer, that might be something that existed in the past, but today we're builders. We've got raw materials, and we kind of try and have to figure out, what do we do with this? How do I make something of this? I know I've got all the pieces. I know that I'm supposed to do something. I don't know what that is, though. And trying to figure that out, that therein lies the challenge. And as educators, and that's an educator, whether we're at work, whether at home, whether we're amongst our congregations, but we're all, to some extent, educators. As an educator, we're kind of transitioning from that builder mode into the seer, into the runner. You know, maybe we haven't seen the perfect product, but we have some idea. We've heard what it looks like, and now we're trying to communicate it. And so, as we look at the various things that existed in the tabernacle in the Mishkan, we'll learn a little bit more about what our job could be. Because, you know, I just realized that we're looking at a very ugly version. We're looking at my Word document when we have a beautiful PDF we can look at instead. And so, if you'll indulge me for just one moment, we're going to open up our PDF. Never mind, not worth it. There were probably 10 different things that exist in the Mishkan, and they were built in different ways, but there are three of great significance, three that are built differently than the rest. You know, you can imagine how challenging it was in the desert to construct almost anything out of gold. You know, they had to had to build a furnace, but then they had to fire up the furnace, melt down the gold so that they could formulate things the way they want. But perhaps the most complicated things for them to build, I mean, a lot of these things were boxes. You know, a table was effectively a box. You know, the altar was effectively a box with a ramp. Not so hard, not so complicated. However, there were two things that were very complicated. One of them was not the Aron, not the Ark, but that which sat on top of the Ark. And you know what? I should have prepared this in advance, but I didn't. So we're going to do it right now. But we call them the cherubs or the kruvim. And these were angelic-looking figures. You know, we can see here, with elaborate wings that were joined together. And crazy as it sounds, the Jewish people were told, this item, this creation, is supposed to be made of one singular block of gold. You're supposed to hammer it out. They're supposed to be miksha, as we say in Hebrew. These things were hammered out. Impressive. You know what else is hammered out? The menorah. You know, we can likely picture the menorah, but still, we'll take a look. The menorah was supposed to be this beautiful, large thing. It's not necessarily just the menorahs that we see. You know, when you type in menorah, you get, you know, the modern day ones. But the menorah in the temple was, first of all, huge, but not just huge. It was beautifully intricate. You know, you can see the cups at the top of the menorah here. There was a lot of intricacy there. You know, there's a beautiful Dvar Torah that we're not going to share right now about the fact that it's both intricate and made of one piece. And so these two things, arguably the hardest things to make in the entirety of the temple, are supposed to be made of one singular unit. They're supposed to be hammered work as opposed to, you know, crafted together. And so, and then there's one other thing that doesn't come up in these portions. It comes up later on, but the trumpets. The trumpets that Moses makes were also supposed to be made of miksha, of just hammered work. And so, you know, you look at this and you see there are these three items that are made differently than everything else. And if there are three items that kind of stand out, those three items must teach us something, must be something happening with the three of them. And so let's think about this. What's special about the Ark, the menorah, the candelabra, and the trumpets, or the katzotros? Well, Rabbi J.J. Schachter, who's a scholar and a rabbi in Yeshiva University, he often likes to share the message that the Ark represents the Torah. And the Torah needs to be made of one single unit. The trumpets represent the call to the Torah, the call to come in. But there's something interesting about the Ark as opposed to the trumpets. Because the trumpets, as we see in the Gemara Masechet Menachot, are not allowed to be reused. You know, I refer to them as plastic. You know, in Israel, when they have plastic, they don't call it plastic. People will say plastic, but when they have disposable things, they'll call them chad pa'mi. You know, you can use it one time. And effectively, the trumpets were a one-time use kind of gig, because Moses was instructed to make his trumpets, but Joshua, who took over for him, was not allowed to use those trumpets. Joshua had to make his own trumpets. Now, why do they need to be remade? Well, this seems like a waste of the silver. But, explains Rabbi J.J. Schachter, the trumpets were the call to Torah. The call to Torah, the call to the lessons of Judaism that we so much value, that changes every single generation. That every 5 years it could change. What's going to pull someone in, what's going to interest somebody, is always going to look different. It's always going to sound different. And so you need to change your trumpets. You need to change the call to this is valuable each and every generation. However, even though the trumpets would always change, the Ark did not change. The Ark was also made mikshah, and that represents the Torah. It represents the values that we have, and those values don't change. Those values are everlasting. And so as much as we adjust and that we change things around of how someone's going to engage, of the frame of things, we're not going to change it entirely. I have a very good friend, Rabbi David Beshefkin, who works for NCSY. He works for the youth organization, and he is the director of education. He is the scholar, and he has this framework for Dvar Torah. I don't know if anyone likes magic, but he says that really a good Dvar Torah, should be a magic trick. And so we're going to do a very bad magic trick right now. I'm not trying to impress anyone, just to be very clear. Just this is an example. But here we go. A magic trick has three parts. I'm holding my ring, and a magic trick has three parts. There is, there's the opening, which is called the pledge. And the pledge basically says, this is an ordinary ring. I took it off my finger. There's nothing exceptional about it. And when presenting a Dvar Torah, you'll present a regular idea. Nothing special about this. This is sort of just a regular concept. But then there's something that we call the turn. And the turn is when you do something unusual. So in this case, I'm sure we've seen this before. In the case of the ring, if I wanted to perform a magic trick, I would take the ring and put it into my hand. And now, because I grabbed it with my left hand or right hand, depending on the mirroring of the image, you would imagine that the ring should now be in my left hand. So I'm going to ask you, and you're going to tap on this hand, and I'm going to open up, and surprise, surprise, it's not there. It's disappeared. And the second part of a Dvar Torah, the turn, if you will, is supposed to create a problem. Something's weird about this. Create an issue within the storyline that we're familiar with. And now you've brought people's interest, but to quote the movie The Prestige, people don't just want to see you make something disappear, because now then it's gone. That's depressing. The bird has now vanished. My ring is now gone. And so the key thing, Michael Caine says very beautifully, you have to bring it back. And that's what the third act of a magic trick is, the prestige. You've got to bring the ring back. And so even though my left hand is empty and you're wondering where in the world could the ring be, that's usually when I would reach behind someone's ear or it would pop up in a bag or something, and voila, we brought the ring back. And the conclusion of a Dvar Torah is just that. It's when you presented something normal, you've shown that this is a mess, and then you bring it back and you resolve the issue. So I asked my friend Rabbi Shefkin, so okay, that's how you structure your Dvar Torah, that's how you structure a class in general. How do you change things when you're talking to a group of adults? You know, he's a scholar, he's a rabbi doctor, he's got a scholar from the New School in economics, and he talks to 14-year-olds about Judaism. How do you change your lessons depending on the crowd. And he says the lesson is always stays the same because the Torah doesn't change. The Torah is constant. So what changes? He says, well, the pledge is going to change. That initial introduction. And I think that it's a beautiful, it's a perfect, it's a parable, it's a perfect transition, a perfect metaphor for what we're seeing right here. That the trumpets, the call, you know, the initial way to pull someone's interest, that might change. You know, the way that we frame a discussion might change, but the content therein, what you're really communicating, that trick, if you will, is always going to be the same. We're never going to change things up. And so maybe one generation will find this more interesting. When a different generation will find this presentation more interesting. You know, maybe with one group of people, you know, when having a conversation, my own experience, when having a conversation with teenage boys, if you make it about basketball or football, they're much more likely to listen than if you make it about politics. But if you're having a group of educated individuals, politics might be more interesting. You know, public policy might be more interesting. Medicine might be more interesting. But the lessons therein are always going to be the same, no matter what group you're talking to, no matter what generation that you're talking to. And that's such an important lesson, because there's something interesting about the ark as well. The ark not only was made of, the top of the ark was not only made of one piece, but the ark had poles. Now, let's recall that what's happening in the Torah portions now is that we're transporting a tabernacle, we're transporting the Mishkan through the desert. And so every single one of the items had holes in it, had slots, and they would slide the pole in order to travel. And so the candelabra, the menorah, they would slide the poles in, hoist it on their shoulders, and walk. And whenever they settled, they put it back down, pull the poles out, put it in storage. And same thing with the table or the altar. They'd put the poles in, put it on their shoulders, go for a walk. When they arrived, they put it down, pull the poles out, and put it in storage. And yet for the ark, they would travel, put it on their shoulders, and when they arrived, they put it down, but they wouldn't remove the poles. The poles would stay in always. And Rav Sham Shon Farl Hirsch in Berlin in the 1800s taught that the reason that the poles stay inside the ark at all times is that the Torah doesn't change. The Torah is transportable. The lessons that we want to impart didn't go stale. They didn't stop being relevant. Those lessons are just as relevant today as they were 100, 200, 300, 2,000 years ago. And the poles are there to show that the ark is not resting. The ark might be here, but if you need it to be over there, if you need to apply a lesson, if Judaism has what to say about any topic, about any time. And I've had a lot of campers over the years. And when I was applying for my first job, I was applying to a school in Philadelphia called Kohelet. And the teacher there was a fantastic educator. I loved the questions that she asked. And she said, if I spoke to your students or to your campers, what would they tell you about me? You know, what would that description be? And I confirmed afterward, and thankfully I think for a lot of my students this is true, that you'll have a very tough time convincing me that something is devoid of holiness, that there's any activity that doesn't have a Jewish lesson in it. And so, you know, whether it's sports, whether it's history, whether it's science, whether it's politics, there's always a Torah angle because the poles of the ark were never removed. There was never a point in time where the Torah was resting here and it applied in this one instance and not anywhere else. And so that lesson of, yes, how someone's going to be pulled into the Torah, that might change, but what the Torah is going to teach them, that will never change. And that's sort of one thing to keep in mind whenever we might be inspired to share lessons, that yes, is the text that was used, is the text that you studied last month with Rabbi Gold, is that the same text that you might use with someone else? No, but the lessons learned are going to be just as applicable. You know, my mother runs her own business. She's a physical therapist, and I once found out that the Torah classes she attends with Rabbi Akiva Tatz, she pays for using her business card. I hope I'm not getting her in trouble for this. I'm like, Mom, why are you allowed to pay with your business card? And she says, this is for business. You're a physical therapist. How is Torah learning part of your business? And she happens to be an exceptional physical therapist. And usually people go to her when all the other therapists haven't worked out. You know, she's an at-home therapist. It's a little sort of a different kind. I wouldn't say alternative medicine, but a little bit alternative medicine. And she says that so frequently, what helps her patients is not just the physical treatment, but the spiritual and emotional treatment. And a lot of those lessons she learns from her weekly Torah classes with Rabbi Akiva Tetz. And to appreciate that the lessons that we learn are not just going to apply in the narrow form, but even in a therapy practice, it could be helpful. It could be informative. And so maybe that's one lesson. We're going to see two more that'll take a little bit less time. The story is told in the Gemara Masechet Bava Metzia about two rabbis, Rabbi Hanina and Rabbi Chiya. And I guess this is some sort of like a rabbi competition. You know, they would debate back and forth. And I guess there's a little bit of smack talk, if I may say. And Rabbi Hanina tells Rabbi Chiya that if the Torah were forgotten from the Jewish people, I could restore it with my powers of analysis. I am so brilliant that I could figure it all out. I could recreate the entirety of the Torah and the Talmud. And, you know, the whole Talmud that I have sitting behind me, he's convinced that he could recreate all 2,711 pages. Rabbi Chiya responds and he says, "What? That's not impressive. Now, you're saying if the Torah were forgotten, I could fix it." But he says, "I ensure the Torah will never be forgotten." And he says, "What do I do?" And he says, "Let's imagine the Torah might be forgotten. Here's how I prevent it. I go and I sow flax seeds and I twine nets. And then I hunt deer and I feed their meat to orphans." So he finds deer and he feeds the meat to the orphans. "Next, I prepare parchment from the hides of those deer and I write the five books of the Torah on them. So now we have the Torah, we have the lessons." And he says, "I go to a city and I teach five children the five books, one book per child. And I teach six other children the six orders of Mishnah. And so now we have the entirety of the written Torah and the entirety of the oral tradition. And I say to them, until I return and come here, read each other the Torah, teach each other the Mishnah." And so he walks up to 11 individuals and says, "You are now responsible to carry on this tradition to someone else. I need you to teach everybody else." And he says, "I'll be back, don't worry." But it's not really so much about him being back. He could have very easily just written the Torah, give it to one individual, said, "Here, put it in the ark, you know, put it into the synagogue, and be fine." But he doesn't do that. He deliberately splits it up and says, "You need to worry about this. This needs to be something that you focus on." One of the ways to impart wisdom and to impart information on someone else is to give them a reason to care. One of the things that I feel exceptionally strongly about in the world of education is that you need to, and not just education, of engagement, is that you need to give people responsibility. When you work with donors, sometimes you'll ask a volunteer to join in, not necessarily because you need their help, but because you want them to volunteer. You want them to give, because once you have a level of responsibility, now you're more engaged in the topic. You're more engaged in the subject. And so, you know, if I'm running a home for sick children, I might ask someone, "Hey, is it possible for you to go pick up the medication?" I could have the medication delivered by someone else, but if I ask you to pick up the medication, you know, you see that, you know, the tons of bottles of medication these kids need, you're going to say, "Wow, I have to do more for these kids." It's going to engage you even further. And when running educational programs, my number one goal was always to get students to teach. Even if the lesson wasn't going to be as good as what I was going to teach, it was so important that they teach, because if they're teaching, then they're engaged. Then there's a responsibility. Then they feel like they have something that they're supposed to give over, and they will care about that program much more. My friend calls it ownership. And so, you know, whether it's organizing a monthly class, whether it's something in the congregation, whether it's any organization we're working with, people who know what they're doing are always going to figure out how to engage as many people as possible in setting up. Because once you've been involved in setting things up, then you're going to care much more. And so Rabbi Chiya does the same thing. Rabbi Chiya says, "You are now responsible to impart lessons on someone else. You want someone to care about something? Tell them that they have to take care of it. Tell them that they're supposed to care about it, and that they're responsible for it, and no one else is going to do it." And then they lean in a little bit more. That's lesson number two. And lesson number three is not so much in imparting, but in reflecting. Because in this week's portion, in the clothing that the high priest would wear, we learn about something called the tzitz. Now the tzitz, in English, we translate as a frontlet. That's a terrible translation. I don't know what a frontlet is. That's kind of like when we translate tefillin as phylacteries. And Lubavitcher Rebbe, you know, in the 70s, was convincing all of his chassidim that they should stand at street corners convincing people to put on tefillin. And someone suggested, why don't you tell them to put on phylacteries, not tefillin? And Lubavitcher Rebbe said, no one knows what a phylactery is. No one knows what tefillin is. So you may as well tell them to put on tefillin. That's the Hebrew word. Let them learn a Hebrew word. Okay. So the tzitz was a golden plate. It said, Kodesh LaHashem, you know, holy to God, on the plate. And the high priest would walk around wearing it. And the rabbis tell us that the entirety of the time that the Kohen Gadol was wearing this Kodesh LaHashem plate on his forehead, the Jewish people would be atoned from basically any mistake that could take place in the offerings in the temple. There are a lot of ways to mess up a korban, but even so, most of them would sort of go away in the event that he's wearing the tzitz. What's the connection between those two things? Why, if someone's just wearing like a random piece of gold, does that mean that everyone else is going to be fine? Perhaps we could suggest that wearing the tzitz is a representation of an attitude, of a personality. Because the Gemara Masechet Moed Katan, I don't know if anybody here does Daf Yomi, you know, the daily portion of Talmud, the daily page of Talmud, but this came up a couple weeks ago, that I'm going to read it in Hebrew and translate it into English, that Kisivse Kohen Yishmeru Das, you know, the lips of a priest are the garters of Das, of knowledge, V'tor Yivak Shemipiyu, and the Torah you should ask from that person, Ki Malach Hashem Tzvakosu, because this personality, this priest, is like an angel of God. And the Talmud teaches us, Im Doma HaRav LeMalach Hashem, if a teacher is like an angel, Yivakshu Torah Mipiv, then you should request that individual to teach you Torah. V'im Lav, but if the teacher is not like an angel, Al Yivakshu Torah Mipiv, don't learn Torah from someone who is not angelic. Don't learn Torah from somebody who doesn't represent the values of Torah. And perhaps we can suggest that the high priest, by wearing that plate on his forehead, was not representing just the fact that he's wearing something gold, but what he was communicating was that he's wearing something, showing his commitment. And he was a walking example of what a Jew looks like, of what a Torah personality looks like. And so even if people made mistakes, they realized their mistakes, and they got past it. They atoned for it because they saw a prime example of what they could be, what they should be. They, if you will, they saw an angel. And sometimes we worry about, how am I going to communicate this message? How am I going to impart this wisdom that I've gleaned on a generation of people, like the Provost Altamidim says in the 1930s, who aren't interested in listening? Or in the 1960s, where we create institutions that are designed to not learn from someone who might know more. Or in the 1990s, where people aren't really interested in what they grew up with. Or in the world today, where, yeah, maybe you learn something, maybe you have experience, but I'm not convinced that that's really true. It's all really relative. Maybe sometimes we even worry too much about, how am I going to communicate this message? And sometimes the best way to communicate a message is to not say a word at all. To just live that message instead. And when you live that message, people end up just learning by example. They frequently say in education that your students are not necessarily going to remember what you teach them, but they will remember the way that you made them feel. And if we can represent a life of Torah, then we can be what we call a walking Kiddush Hashem, you know, a sanctification of God's name, which is ultimately our goal. That if I can be an example of a walking Kiddush Hashem, if I can be an example of what a Jew could or should look like, then someone else will say, you know, if that's what she looks like, if that's what he looks like, maybe the Torah is something valuable to share. The Gemara Masechet Yuma, this is my favorite Gemara. I think we've actually done it before, but on 86a, sorry. Says, what do we mean when we say Shema? And with this, we'll close. At the beginning of the Shema, we say Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, and then the next line is V'ahavta es Hashem Elokecha. You should love Hashem, your God. What does it mean to love God? Now, there are a lot of things we could say to answer that. But the way the Talmud explains, and this really is only one path, but it's really the lesson that we take from it. To love God means sheyehei shem shamayim mis'ahiv al yadecha. That God should be beloved through me, because of me. That someone should look at me and say, that person observes the Torah, that person is Jewish, that person lives a Jewish lifestyle, that person's awesome, that person's so nice, that person's so kind, so thoughtful, so impressive, has such good manners. That must mean that God is awesome. And the command, the commitment that we make whenever we say the Shema morning and night is that I'm going to do my absolute very best to be a walking example of what we could and should be. And then I'm not going to worry about education per se, but instead, I'm just going to worry internally about me, make myself the best version possible, and let everyone else learn from that example. So I hope this was interesting. I hope this was informative. It's something I've been very excited to think about and to share. And so I appreciate the audience. If we're still interested, we can talk about Kabbalat Shabbat in a couple of months. But with that, I'll bid you good night. I hope that the Alperstein's, that Marcel and her family's mother has, Neshama has an Aliyah, that all of those who were ill will find a refuah shlema. And I would argue, I don't know exactly what Marcel was sharing beforehand about the notion of learning Torah on a yard site, but I will share that I looked into this when I was saying Kaddish for my grandparents, and there's a lot of discussion about Kaddish. Some argue that Kaddish should really only be recited not by every mourner in the sanctuary, but by just, you know, the chazan, just the prayer leader, you know, just similar to the other Kaddishes that we see where only one person says it. Really, only one person should say each one of those times, but for really emotional reasons, we end up allowing everyone to say it, and this is a tradition that dates back 300 years. But whenever that discussion comes up, almost everyone says more or less the same thing. Kaddish is one avenue of sanctifying those who are no longer with us. It's one avenue of creating a merit for those who we've lost. But really, the best avenue for creating a merit for those we lost, for creating a merit for those who are sick, is the process of learning Torah, of teaching Torah, and of just going out and representing Torah to the world. And so I think sort of that last example we gave of the tzitz, of the plate, the forehead plate, of the walking Kiddush Hashem on a yard site, that I think is really the best example. And to such an extent that the former Rebbetzin of our community, she passed away when I was 17, Rebbetzin Shandy Fierstein, Zikron Tzadik, Tzatzal, her children for a few years after she passed away used to send out a mida, a character trait marathon for the time period of her yard site. You know, from when it began at sundown until the next sundown, each and every hour, what can you think about? What can you work on that day to really create that merit for her? They said Kaddish, they did all the things they were supposed to do, but the self-improvement is really what we're aiming toward. And so hopefully what we learned together tonight was some level of self-improvement for us. And that'll create that merit for mothers, for our families and friends who need it so very much. So thank you so much. And that's all I got tonight. Have a good night. Thank you.